Last September, food writer Mark Bittman announced that he was leaving his dream job at the New York Times to become an activist, advocating for a national food policy. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Bittman has worked together with others to develop the outline of a national food policy, and he and Ricardo Salvador, director for the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, are bringing that message to Iowa this week. I'll talk with them. Then later in the hour, a conversation with artist Laurel Nakadade about her photography exhibit, Strangers and Relations. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, a conversation with artist Laurel Nakadade. She grew up in Ames. We'll be talking about her exhibition, which is on display right now at the Des Moines Art Museum. It's called Strangers and Relations. But first, food writer Mark Bittman left his dream job at the New York Times last fall in part to pursue his advocacy and activism. He's partnered with a number of other very influential people in the world of food to call for a national food policy. He and one of his partners, Ricardo Salvador, who is director for the Food and Environment Program for the Union of Concerned Scientists, are bringing that message to Iowa this week. They'll be talking with the Iowa Farmers Union, the Women Food and Ag Network, the Sierra Club of Iowa, and other groups about their ideas and asking Iowans to ask presidential candidates about food policy during this political season. And they are both here with me today. Mark Bittman, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Well, happy to be here.
Ricardo Salvador is also here with us today. Hello, Ricardo.
Hi there, Charity.
Welcome back to Iowa, almost. You'll be traveling here this week. Now, you used to teach at Iowa State University, right?
That's right. I was on the faculty there and lived in Iowa for almost 28 years, so I actually consider myself an Iowan.
Wonderful. And I want to talk to you as the hour goes on about the fact that you were the first person to teach a class at Iowa State University on sustainable agriculture. I'd love to get your thoughts on how things have changed. But I want to start with this idea of a national food policy. And Mark, I'll let you go first. When you say national food policy, what does that mean?
Well, it can mean any number of things, but I like to – Ricardo is much better at details than I am, so we'll let him give you the long answer. But, I like to think that we could have a policy that said that people of the United States are entitled to food that's green, that's fair, that's affordable, and that's nutritious. Those are things we can probably agree upon, and we don't have anything approaching such a policy. We just have a bunch of de facto policies that basically say – food should be profitable for the people who market it. And that is not, that has neither workers nor land nor animals nor eaters, that is all of us, in mind. It just has corporate affairs in mind.
Well, and Ricardo, what do you want to add to that? When we think about, we talk a lot in Iowa, we talk a lot all over the place about our food system in the United States, but both of you have pointed out that we don't really have a food system.
Right. Well, I'll add to what Mark has already described the following observation, and that is that this nation has for over 100 years been investing heavily in creating a leading food system. And by that I mean there's been a great deal of science, there's been a great deal of infrastructure that has been created with public investment. Public investment is the thing to underscore. And the outcome of this, as Mark brilliantly noted in one of his columns, is that it's hard to imagine a nation that has done such an excellent job looking at the problems of productivity and the technical issues that surround agriculture, and then to do such a bad job with it in the end, because the outcome is that the way in which we eat makes us sick. And if this were just a market outcome, then none of us would have a whole lot to say about this. But it is not just a market outcome. It is a severely distorted system where public dollars are going into producing too much of the wrong stuff, namely the stuff that makes us sick. So when we say that we need a national food policy, it is not about dictating what people ought to eat. It is about making sure that when the USDA and other public health officials make recommendations for how we should eat for maximum health and a thriving, productive life, that all of us actually have a chance to have access to such a food system. And at the moment, only the very wealthy are able to enjoy the very best of what the food system produces. And that should not be the case. That's a distortion. All of us, to the extent that the food system is a result of our tax dollars, public investment, should have access to that food system that Mark described, food that is healthy, green, fair, and affordable. So the national food policy would be to come up with basic common sense ideas that do not work across purposes, that do not contravene each other, but that add up to that result. So, you know, just to elaborate on that, probably the example of contradiction, you know, complete nonsensical policies working against each other that everyone is familiar with, is that, as everyone saw just a couple of weeks ago, the USDA every 5 years generates recommendations for dietary guidelines. They're, when you look at them, they're primarily a plant-based diet. They don't eliminate meat. You know, meat is there, but in sparing quantities. The thing is that when you look at the way that that very same department actually expends its research dollars and all of its resources, it actually is to support a food system that generates the junk food that is making all of us sick and giving us premature death due to cardiac diseases, the number one killer of Americans. So we were just talking about bringing common sense and aligning what the public till is doing with public outcomes so that we all can enjoy healthful, thriving, productive lives.
Now, speaking about those diet recommendations that came out shortly after they were released, I heard a piece on Morning Edition about the fact that you mentioned meat is there, that there is extensive lobbying that goes into the creation of those recommendations from different organizations. For example, the beef lobby in the United States. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Right, exactly. So, you know, just so that it's clear to everyone, we have tremendous costs that the public assumes due to the way that we eat. We're not just talking about individual choices and individual outcomes here. So this prevailing food system ends up costing us over $200 billion annually if you just measure in terms of obesity-related healthcare costs. If you add diabetes on top of that, there's $175 billion there. When you take a look at those that have an interest in us over-consuming all of the wrong stuff, this junk food diet, you know, there's sales domestically reaching about $800 billion in that food system. I'd argue that's $800 billion that say things are going to stay just the way that they are, and that's what you're referring. Those interests really apply pressure. You know, they apply pressure to the Secretary of Agriculture. They apply pressure to Congress to make sure that those dietary guidelines were not inimical to their interests. The industry as a whole these days is actually investing about $150 million annually for that lobbying that you're talking about. So this means that instead of the public tax dollars that I've been naming serving the public interest, that in fact we've got those going into private good. So there's an issue of basic democracy, there's an issue of scientific integrity, and of course the bottom line is just the public well-being. Our food system should result in a nation that's nourished and doing well rather than a nation that's sick because of its food system.
Now, of course, if you ask pretty much any American if the government should be able to tell them how they eat, or if you ask any farmer if the government should be able to tell them how to farm, the answer would be no. But it sounds like both of you are saying that because of the government policies that we have in place, you feel that that is exactly what the government is doing. Mark, is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah. I mean, and it's not, you know, just not to get too far afield, it's not just food. There's a whole attitude that, well, the government shouldn't be telling us what we're doing. But government policies shape what happens in the market. The market doesn't exist in a vacuum. And the way that policies have shaped what's happening now, not just in food, but in just about everything, is not to the benefit of most Americans. So I'm not interested in telling people how to eat. I'm interested in telling people what appears to be the most nutritious way to eat. I mean, that's of interest to some people, but people can listen or not. But I do think we're all interested in protecting our land. I think few of us are interested in torturing animals. I think many of us would like to see workers treated better, and that is not going to happen in a vacuum. So the plaintiff, "Well, don't tell me how to eat," is really just industry shill for saying don't regulate us when it's necessary. And people are generally in favor of environmental regulations when they work. And, you know, that's a good example of how contemporary agriculture is not functioning in all of our interests. It's environmentally degrading rather than being, you know, rather than approaching something sustainable.
Ricardo, I want to talk for a moment about that first class you taught on sustainable agriculture at Iowa State University, because from my perspective, having been in media in Iowa for a very long time, even our definition of sustainable agriculture has changed pretty dramatically from when it first became something that we were talking about. Is that your perspective?
Yeah, I think that's a very sharp observation, Charity. I hope you don't mind me being familiar with you. I spent so many years listening to you on NPR in Iowa that I feel like I know you, so please excuse the liberty. I actually saw that develop over a number of years, and what we're talking about here is a learning curve. So it's not that there's any major controversy, nor should there be, about a basic dictionary definition around sustainability. You know, basically, how long can you keep up a process? You know, a process that is sustainable is not bounded in time. So there's no controversy about that. The question is, when you apply it to any human activity, whether we actually have the know-how or the will to adopt practices that make it so what we're talking about is not bounded in time. Agriculture as a whole, the way that we currently practice it, is a tremendous success story, but which is severely bounded in time. We cannot continue present practices indefinitely. And so we're very vulnerable in terms of some very critical inputs that are required to make the system work at the moment. And so the period of time that you're referring to was back in the 80s when the state of Iowa had gone through one of the periodic busts in its agricultural economy due to overinvestment. And it also was a time of severe environmental crisis. And, you know, without describing that whole period of time again, what it meant was that there was a great deal of interest. And, in fact, the state legislature invested in the creation of a center, the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, for Iowans as a whole, the population as a whole, to learn about more sustainable agricultural practices. And so at that period of time, the definition of sustainability was seen as a constraint. Every definition that you ever saw of sustainability had a pattern. It went along the lines of, we want to do X subject to constraints, you know, 1, 2, through N. You know, every definition that you saw had that sort of format. Yeah.
Okay. And we'll talk about how that has shifted over time in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to talk about food policy in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about food politics and food policy in the United States. With me, food writer Mark Bittman. Also with me this hour, Ricardo Salvador, who is the director for the Food and Environment Program for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He also used to be an agronomy professor at Iowa State University and taught the first class on sustainable agriculture at Iowa State. And that's what we were talking about when we had to take a short break, Ricardo. So let's go back to that. You were talking about how when we first started talking about sustainable agriculture or sustainability, it was a constraint. So this is, I'm farming in this way, but I am constrained by these factors. That's how we were talking about it. How do you feel that that has shifted?
Right. So as opposed to the view that farming would be all about, say, high yield, high productivity, subject to the constraint that, well, you must minimize the amount of soil that you erode or the runoff pollution from your farming practices and so on. The view today, which I'm going to term agroecological, I know it's a very big word, but it basically means the application of what we know about ecology to one of the prime settings where we interface with the natural world, which is agriculture. Now we see sustainability is basically a multiple purpose activity that is a building activity, synthetic activity, where we're not focused on the constraints around a key thing that we're doing, a single thing that we're doing. So in the agroecological perspective, of course, the farmer must thrive. There must be livelihood there. That's the key reason for that activity as an economic activity. But now we see that in the same way that you can foster productivity, you can also be building soil, not be worried about how you can minimize soil erosion. You can actually be providing ecological services that clean water and actually provide greater access to clean water, and to looking at this at how you're going to minimize the amount of, say, nitrate runoff that is going to pollute water and so on. So you can increase biodiversity, and also, if, you know, to the point of the very first item in this conversation, what we produce is actually nutritious food. You know, everything that you're doing is synthetic. It's building. It's not one thing that we're optimizing the system for, subject to constraints. And so that has been a real major switch in the way in which we look at sustainability from the scientific standpoint.
And on a related subject, we have this email from Brian in Iowa City. He says, do we need a better word than sustainability? Not that I disagree with the concept, but when stacked against the free market rhetoric of a word like growth, sustainability seems a bit uninspiring. What do you think about that?
Well, this is Mark's department. I rely on him when it comes to communication.
All right, Mark.
You know, it's a fantastic question, and it's something I've probably been involved in half a dozen conversations over the course of the last year, intense conversations in which people are trying to figure out what the right word is. But, you know, this question has not been posed to me in this way before, and I don't know that you can counter the word growth, but there really are two arguments here. One is, what is sustainable? And, you know, we could call sustainable agriculture responsible. We could call it ethical. We could call it any number of things, and they're all words that are positive. I think there is another question, and that is, what is growth, and do we want it? And it needs to be addressed in a different conversation at different times and separately, because I think if we say, yes, we want agriculture to be fill in the blank, whatever word you like, that is a direction we need to go in. But there is a separate question, and the question is growth necessary? And is growth inevitable? Because if you answer that, if you answer no to either of those, then we have to figure things out differently. And there are people, including many progressive people, who can't imagine an economy without growth. But it can be imagined, and it needs to be imagined, because we know that resources aren't infinite. And growth implies, infinite growth implies that resources are infinite, and that has to be a mistake in the long run. This is not something that's going to be tackled this week or even this presidential campaign, but these are issues that need to be discussed, you know, I think calmly and intelligently, and maybe we can get to that place.
Well, Ricardo, when you were talking about teaching about sustainability in the 80s and how that definition has changed, that strikes me that that represents significant progress in the movement that you're working on. I mean, do you feel that way? Is it, or is it not fast enough? Is it not enough?
Well, yes, I feel that there's been progress. As I mentioned, this is a learning curve, and you know, probably, you know, as a teacher, as a researcher, I see that just as a natural course of human affairs, that when we set an objective, we need to then learn about how we're going to meet that objective, including how we talk about it. However, I also want to say that we can expend a great deal of energy on the misdirection about what these words mean. I think, as Mark says, we're very clear what we're talking about here. Whether these systems are regarded as regenerative in the sense that I mentioned, and that, you know, you're not worried about the constraints on the system, but actually how you can build up the system, or whether we consider them to be resilient, meaning that they can counter and survive any challenge that they encounter, whether it's economic, human-made, a natural disaster, they're all attributes of the type of food system that we all deserve, particularly since we're talking about public investment and public intentions when we're talking about public policy. So I can get into the discussions around terminology, you know, ad infinitum, together with the best of them, but I think it's important to keep our eye on what we're trying to achieve here, and that is that in this political season, together with every other mainline item which politicals are rightly discussing in the national discourse, you know, gun safety, economic inequality, global change, global security, all of these sorts of things, food is right up there because it actually ties all of those things together.
Well, and Mark, before we talk about the different political candidates and the what you're hoping to inject into this conversation right now, right before caucus season in Iowa, I want to ask you a similar question to what I just asked Ricardo. And that is, you know, when I think about the first time I heard about eating locally and that term locavore came up and people started talking about it, the local foods movement has really gained a lot of steam, made a lot of changes. We're seeing a lot more small, sustainable farms in Iowa today than we were 10 years ago and certainly than we were 20 years ago. This grassroots movement is doing something. I mean, why focus on the top when the bottom is growing so well at this moment?
Great question. But I mean, my immediate response is, who says we're focusing on the top at the expense of the bottom? I think we need to focus on both. And if you look at the, let's call it sustainable food movement, just to keep hammering away at that word. If you look at that, it is significant and it is visible and it does matter and it's important and great and so on. But it is not scaled, and there's no way that it is scaled. And until we figure out a way to scale it, which I think means how do we transfer some land into the hands of people who want to farm responsibly or sustainably, until we figure that out, the ways in which we're going to save our health, save our land, save our water are going to be to try to reform what you might call industrial and is sometimes called conventional agriculture, because a 10% change in the way things are done in most of Iowa has far more impact than any kind of change that we're going to see in the sustainable food movement in the near future.
I'm talking with Mark Bittman, food writer, and many other things as well. Also with me this hour, Ricardo Salvador, director for the Food and Environment Program for the Union of Concerned Scientists. They are both coming to Iowa this week to talk about their idea for a national food policy. They'll talk with the Iowa Farmers Union, the Women Food and Ag Network, the Sierra Club of Iowa, and other groups about their ideas. They're also asking Iowans to ask presidential candidates about food policy. And the two of you, along with other collaborators, have been asking presidential candidates about food policy. Mark, what kind of a response have you gotten?
Well, none. I mean, to be quite honest, and we've been, we've been hammering at this for 18 months or so now. And, frankly, I don't think, I really don't expect Republicans to pay much attention. And I'm disappointed that even the most progressive candidate out there, who's Bernie Sanders, is not really paying much attention to what we're saying. And the way things are shaping up, it looks very much like Hillary Clinton's campaign is figuring that whatever Barack Obama's attitude towards food was is going to be good enough for them also. And it's not. So, I mean, we're coming to say these things. We're coming to say, you know, a lot of what the three of us have been talking about for the past half hour. And we hope that, I think at this point, we hope that many people will listen and start to push presidential candidates on this, because clearly our individual voices are not having much impact.
Now, I've read through the pieces that you've worked on with Michael Pollan about national food policy, and there are many, many suggestions within these articles, and even suggesting creating a new governmental department, the U.S. Department of Food, Health, and Well-Being. From your perspective, and I'll let you go first on this, Ricardo, what is, if one thing could change with national food policy, what would the priority be? What's the most important thing?
It's actually answered in that line that you just quoted, Charity, and that is that, you know, what public policy is basically the manifestation of authority to direct public resources toward a particular end. And if we have a particular end in mind with food system, it is health and well-being. So, you know, it is damning, I think, in 2016 that we should have to specify that a desired attribute of our food system is that it makes us well and that it nourishes us. You know, because I'm a scientist, I'll get just a little bit wonky here, but in the sciences, an area that's called systems analysis, where you look at the way in which complex systems operate to give you a particular end, there are two different kinds of systems. There's a system which is predictable. It is referred to as a hard system, like your watch, for instance. But when people are involved, there are many more dynamics that are not predictable, and that is a system that is referred to as soft. And what is known from studying those kinds of systems, that the single best way of getting them to produce a different outcome, in other words, of changing them, is to re-specify what their purpose is. Now, as Mark said, we don't have an official food policy in this nation, but there is a very clear de facto food policy. If you look at what is enabled by everything that we do in the realm of food and agricultural policy, though all of these things are not enacted all in one place in a coordinated way to produce a specific end, what it actually is, de facto, is exploiting people and nature for agribusiness profit. If you look at all the things that we do, that's what we enable. So what we're proposing is that instead what we enable is a food and agricultural system that produces actual food, health, and well-being. And that's why we propose that as one way of achieving this objective, we actually just not only just rename but redefine what the Department of Agriculture is about. It is by now such a large and conflicted department, you know, trying to provide dietary headlines on the one side, and then the other side being the sales department for agricultural commodities. You know, these are things that can't exist under the same roof and which we should not be abetting anymore. You've got some of the largest corporations in the world that have built into their business model that the full faith and trust of the U.S. Treasury backs them so that nothing could go wrong with their businesses, at least in terms of their primary inputs. So this is what we're asking for, basically a rethinking of the way that public resources are invested for the greatest good, for the greatest public outcome. And so I would just repeat that line that you quoted. You know, we should be all about investing for food, health, and well-being.
Of course, the Farm Bill is probably the highest profile time that people think about food policy in the United States. And the Farm Bill is something that covers so many different parts of how we eat and how we farm in the country. Do you feel like the Farm Bill is part of this process? Is this something that we can continue to work with?
We could talk.
Who do you want to answer this?
Well,
go, Mark.
Well, I mean, I'll answer quickly. We could talk about the Farm Bill for a long time, but the fact is it is so arcane and so geared to supporting the status quo that I think that at this point, yes, we pay attention to it. Yes, we try to change it for the better, but we also have to work apart from it and work around it because, you know, we have a friend who I suppose can remain nameless who taught a course in the Farm Bill, and she said, I didn't understand it when I started to teach the course, and I didn't understand it when I finished teaching the course. And I think that's going to be true for all of us. We are not going to understand the Farm Bill, and we are not going to be able to, as individuals or even as a group, be able to have much effect on it. What we can do is talk about alternative systems, as we've done, and we can talk about pushing politicians and other leaders to give us the kind of food system that we so desperately need and actually deserve.
So what is your message? And Mark, you can go first. What's your message to Iowans this week in coming to the state in caucus season? What do you want people to hear?
Well, my message would be when you are able to confront candidates, and I'm not just talking about leading presidential candidates, but anyone running for public office ever, you say to them, what's your position on food? Period. I want to know. because no one asks, or very few people ask, these questions. And this is, we need to have people who see themselves as leaders start to pay attention to how we grow, market, and eat food in the United States.
Ricardo, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, I could not agree more with Mark's statement. And maybe to provide a little bit more guidance, because most of the politicals right now would probably just stare blankly, you know, when asked that question, for the very reason that Mark says, that we're not accustomed to discussing this in the same vein that we discuss all of the other current major items. But, you know, when you talk about food, you really are talking about such things as the nation's immigration policy, our policies about minimum wage and tipped wage. We're talking about enforcing the same regulations on one of the most polluting industries in the country, agriculture, that we would apply to smokestack industries, which we regulated beginning in the 70s and 80s. But for some strange reason, we're not doing the equivalent thing with just as damaging an environmental industry as agriculture, speaking as a whole.
And unfortunately, we are out of time. But thank you both so much for being here today. We're talking with Ricardo Salvador and Mark Bittman. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. How would you react if someone you didn't know invited you to meet her at night in a remote location so she could take your picture? That's how Laurel Nakadate's exhibition Relative Strangers began. It evolved as she photographed distant relations. Nakadate is an artist who grew up in Ames, Iowa, and has made a name for herself with surprising and powerful video and photography exhibits over the years, often revolving around the idea of strangers interacting. And the Relative Strangers exhibit is on display at the Des Moines Art Center through the end of this week, through Sunday, through January 24th. And Laurel is on the line with me now. Hello, Laurel.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And let's talk about how the idea for this project, for Relative Strangers, came about.
It's actually strangers in relations.
Strangers. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's fine. Well, you know, I just finished a project where I was working on the selfie, and I became very interested in doing the anti-selfie. And for me, that meant taking a long look at a single person or a small group of people and making a record of that person that would become a sort of slow, long portrait look of a person at a specific time. So I went out to the desert, and I started inviting strangers to meet me at night in remote locations. I'd ask them to, you know, meet at a specific, at the top of a mountain at a certain time, and I'd make their portrait. Soon after that, I took a DNA test and became really interested in the idea of meeting strangers who were also related to me. So that's the general premise of how it began.
All right. And why in the first place?
I know, it sounds very crazy, right? The whole thing sounds insane. It's like, I just wanted to meet people at night. I wanted to talk to strangers, but that really was it. I was just very curious about, you know, people who are not people in my normal orbit, finding ways to talk to people who would, you know, teach me something about their life.
So tell us about the setup for these photographs, because they are striking photographs. They look different than pretty much any other portraits that you might see. What's the setup?
So, well, thank you. They're all lit with a single flashlight, starlight, and any ambient light that exists in the natural landscape around the people. I wanted to light them with a single flashlight because I wanted to mimic the way we find people in the dark. And I liked the idea of making very simple pictures, pictures that didn't require big studio setups or really complicated equipment or, you know, things that were not approachable. So I thought a single flashlight and a person standing there in the night sky, how can it be more simple? But it also became a very beautiful setup.
Now, when you first started asking people that you hadn't met to meet you, you also told them, you know, bring whatever you want with you that would be in the picture. What kinds of things did people bring?
You know, people brought everything from babies to, I think one woman brought welding equipment, which, you know, was surprising but very welcome. I think a man came in a three-piece suit. one man brought his two brothers. You know, people would bring strange things and normal things and family members and really anything. And that's what was sort of lovely about it, was that they chose to bring whatever they wanted. And through that choice, they described something about themselves.
Was there a lot of diversity in the people who responded to those original asks?
There was and there wasn't, you know, and that was one of the problems with the original part of the project, just the strangers part, was that when you ask friends of friends to come, you end up getting, you know, a lot of people who are not so dissimilar from you, which can be good and bad. I started opening up a little bit wider, doing radio announcements, you know, hey, come to this one place at this one time on the local radio station, Craigslist ads, and it started getting more interesting. However, once I opened it up to the DNA aspect, it became really interesting.
Well, how did that happen? You took one of these DNA tests that anybody can buy. And was that, did you have the idea before you took the test, or did you take the test
No.
and then think, oh, hey, I could do this?
You know, it all started coming together about the same time. I was taking those pictures of the strangers. I took a DNA test just because I was just curious. I think a lot of people who take those tests are just generally curious about who they are and who their ancestors were. So I took the test. And when the results came back, I wasn't so surprised by what it said, you know, about my relatives. But what I was very, very moved by was the diversity and strangeness of people posting pictures of themselves on these DNA sites saying, you know, I'm your third cousin, I'm your fourth cousin. Just there, it's sort of like Facebook DNA for Facebook, or, you know, sort of, I mean, it's strange, right? Because on Facebook, we know, you know, people post all these things and they're out there. But when you've taken a DNA test and you put a profile picture of yourself and you say a little bit about yourself and then you suddenly realize this person is your third cousin, it's strange, and it's hard not to want to try to, as an artist, make something out of it.
We have interviewed your dad on the show before, Neil Nakadare.
Who wrote
about his family's experience being interned at a camp for Japanese Americans in World War II. And so on one side of your family, you have a history that has a strong narrative, at least. Were you exploring both sides of your family with these portraits, or was this to explore the unknown?
Yeah, I mean, initially I wanted to do both sides. When I first started looking at the distant cousins and my distant cousin list, I thought, wouldn't it be great to do both sides? However, I only had a few distant cousins related to me on my father's side. I think because my family's only been in America a little over 100 years, there just aren't very many distant cousins on my father's side. So although I really wanted to, I just couldn't. It just, you know, the setup did not allow me to do that. So as you said, it became more about the unknown. It became more about a side of my family that I know a lot less about. And so, you know, in that way, it was sort of adding on to a family tree that in some ways was a bit of a mystery.
Now, once you identified these people, how did you contact them? What did you say to them about creating a portrait?
So, again, the sort of awkward email of, hi, you don't know me. I'm an artist. I'm wondering if you might let me meet you in a dark location near your home and let me make your portrait. You know, super strange email, and yet people said yes.
Well, and I can imagine that a lot of people who spend time on these sites, they want to get to know their families, and they probably exchange a lot of information and, you know, maybe say, hey, let's, if we're in an area close to each other, let's have lunch or something. But you didn't want to have a relationship with them prior to making the portrait, right?
Not really. I mean, you know, some of the individuals I spoke to on the phone or I chatted with on email because, you know, they wanted to, and that was sort of what they needed to feel comfortable meeting me, and that was absolutely fine. But as a photographer, I really believe in the thing we can create in the moment, and I was really interested in letting, you know, the photograph be the experience or the record of our meeting. And so I tried really hard not to have major relationships with anyone, either online or via the telephone, before meeting them, because I wanted the moment that we met to really mean something and to really be a record of this time, this moment of meeting.
So you would travel somewhere And then you would have to, so you may be in the same town as the person that you are going to photograph. You'd wait until after dark to go see them?
Yeah, I would wait until dark, until, you know, a good time to meet would be sunset, so you could sort of see the landscape around the person and sort out where the great light was going to be coming from over the horizon. And, you know, I'd wait for the moment where it was really, really dark, and then we'd make the photograph. And the photographs are made through long exposures. They're not short exposures, you know, like snapshots that you would make on your cell phone. They're long exposures. And so because of that, the person has to stand still for you for a long time. And so there's really this moment where you're standing across from a stranger with the shutter open, recording their image, recording the moment that you're meeting. And for me, you know, that really meant something. And so, yeah, we're standing in the dark and it's a strange setup. But I think within that, there's this sort of poetic moment that I think everyone sort of acknowledges as meaning something more than, you know, a selfie or a snapshot.
I'm talking with artist Laurel Nakadade. She grew up in Ames, Iowa, and she has an exhibit on display right now at the Des Moines Arts Center. It's on display through Sunday, January 24th. It's called Strangers and Relations. And Laurel, when I look at these photos, like I said, they're really striking images. And you, at least when I look at them, I don't just look and move on. I look for a while because they kind of make you wonder. When you look at these images, what do you see? What do you want to see?
You know, I went into the project not really knowing what I was looking for. It was the sort of unknown thing. And as an artist, I think I'm always trying to be part of something I don't understand, or I'm always trying to have the world teach me something more than I thought even to ask for. So when I set out to make the photographs, I didn't really have an agenda. I just wanted to be part of the project. So now when I look at the project, in some ways I feel like, you know, it's bigger than any idea I could have had for it. And it's not even really about one story, about one person's life. It's about the entire project and all the lives and the culmination of traveling across America for 3 years and meeting all of these people and how every life was so important. You know, every person was an individual who was so important. But really what was important was that it even happened and that all of these people are part of it and that, you know, the project could even exist.
Did you learn something about yourself through this process, do you think?
You know, I did. I feel like growing up in Iowa, I was really well-seated to sort of go out into the world and try to make sense of it. And I think I grew up in a family where story was really important and where asking questions was really important. And I think I sort of proved to myself that I could do that I could go out and try to, you know, find these stories and make sense of things. And, you know, there's a lot of time where I was alone in a car, in a, you know, rental car, driving around the middle of nowhere where there was no cell service, just sort of making sense of things. So, you know, while I always knew I was capable of doing something, you know, I'd never done a 3-year project and really, you know, spent, even my feature films, I only spent a year on, maybe maximum, 10 days shooting and, you know, a couple months editing and then taking the film around. So this project was really the biggest project I've ever done in some ways.
When I also grew up in Iowa, and when I have traveled to places like the East Coast, I find that the way that I approach the world is very different from the way that most people on the street in New York City, for example, approach the world.
Yeah.
And you can kind of get yourself into trouble pretty quickly by making eye contact with strangers and smiling at people and things like that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
A lot of your projects have revolved around interacting with strangers in some really unusual ways. This is not the most unusual way, these strangers and relations photos that you've pursued. Do you think that in part that fascination of interacting with strangers is partially because you are an Iowan transplanted into a different environment?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I really feel that growing up in Iowa gave me such a great start for being an artist, because artists are, you know, meant to ask questions and describe things and stay open to the world. And I think it's so interesting that so many people move to New York City to make art, because New York City isn't a town where people make eye contact, as you said. So, you know, I think in some ways it was a perfect formula of having this Midwestern childhood and, you know, being raised in a family that really supported story. And then, you know, I moved to the East Coast to go to college and grad school, and ended up in New York City. And so it's the strange formula of still really feeling like a Midwesterner, but then sort of having the knowledge of someone who's spent a lot of time on the East Coast now. And I think, you know, part of that is why I was able to complete this project and travel through America in some way that didn't, you know, get me completely lost and turned around.
A lot of your art, including this project, has involved you being alone with strangers in places that you've never been before. And other projects you've done in the past has involved going into people's apartments and being alone with someone you don't know there. That's the kind of thing that a lot of people work pretty hard to avoid doing. So there's an element of danger and risk to what you do. Is that important to your art?
You know, I've been asked this question before, and I don't know that it's necessarily about risk. It's more about uncertainty. And I think, you know, often artists go out into the world and go to places where they are not familiar with and meet people who they may not have normally come in contact with. And, you know, it's the sort of energy between people who don't understand one another that's interesting to me. And, you know, there's a long history of it in making photo in photography, but I think in everyday life it does sound very strange. But I think artists and specifically photographers frequently find themselves in strange places. I know plenty of people have said that they became photographers because they wanted permission to go places. They wanted permission to be part of worlds that they weren't necessarily part of. You know, I remember when I was in high school reading about and looking at the photographs of Deanna Arbus and really being moved by the idea that, you know, she was this girl who grew up in one part of New York City, but really spent most of her life trying to find other parts of New York City. And I think I was really influenced very early on by this idea that the camera can allow us to go anywhere. And so even if we don't really belong in that place, the camera, you know, gives us this passport.
What's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, I think I want to make another film. I've made two feature films, and I'd really like to make a third. So I think that's where it goes. I mean, I never really know, you know, what I'm going to do next until it sort of starts. So, but I think the next thing will be a feature film.
So do you know that something is starting when it starts, or is that something that you understand after the fact?
You know, usually I get an idea and I just start working on it, and either it keeps going or it doesn't. It becomes clear pretty quickly if there's heat on something. You know, with Strangers and Relations, it became very clear to me very quickly that there was some heat there. You know, I shot the first photograph of the series in, Iowa actually. And after that first night of shooting, I knew I needed to keep doing it. There was just some heat on it. And so that's, for me, what it is, you know, what's so great about my job is that there's no rules, but at the same time, you know, I sort of have to really navigate my job and my life for myself because no one's telling me what to do, which is fantastic and also terrifying.
Laurel Nakadade, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Laurel Nakadade, her exhibit, Strangers and Relations, is at the Des Moines Art Museum through Sunday, January 24th. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. We have production assistance today from Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.